Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. Forget all of her wisdom, forget her accomplishments across male-dominated industries like tech and finance, even forget her thoughtful badassery. So much about what is great about this conversation with Natalie Molina Nino, CEO of Brava Investments and author of Leapfrog, The New Revolution for Women Entrepreneurs, and serial entrepreneur herself, is her spirit. She's just a joyful, warm, hilarious, and electrifying presence. Our conversation spans from why investing in women yields greatest profitability to the many approaches necessary to shifting our current power structure. Natalie reminded me to draw strength from the many facets that it takes to create big shifts that we all want to create an equitable society, and that none of us can do it alone and none of us should be doing it alone. Natalie and I compared notes on attending single-sex high school and dove into the powerful muscle memory that that experience instilled in us about what's possible when women are leaders of every club and every team and win everything. Rather than a single-sex environment being an escape from reality, it gave us a taste of what's possible when obstacles are cleared and conditions are created for women to thrive. It's an experience so profoundly formative that it seeps into our bones and nourished us both for the long haul. And it's worth noting that a majority of this recent class of newly elected congresswomen are products of the Girl Scouts, a similar single-sex environment. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Natalie Molina Nino as much as I did. There's an infusing, when I sat down and I thought about you after, you know, deep dive into you and following you for a long time, I see you with this like council of wise women elders, like right over your shoulder a lot. Like, And I know your grandmother has been really, really important into you. And so I wondered if you could just bring me back into your LA childhood kitchen table. What did that look like? What was your cultural milieu? What was that all about? Paint a picture.
It's funny that you say that because I actually have a weird childhood memory that you just reminded me of. That according to my mother didn't happen, but according to me, I distinctly remember, and there are things about this memory that I remember with great accuracy. So I have confirmation that this happened, but there are things about it that I've either enhanced or, you know, as one does, right? But apparently I was about 2 years old. I still have the scar, and somebody left a lit cigarette in the living room, and the kids were playing outside and everybody's sort of, you know, big family gathering. And I just decided to sort of break off from the kids that were playing, come back into the house, grab the lit cigarette, and just like out of curiosity, started to put it on my top of my hand. And it must have smelled funny, it must have looked funny, it must have done something to entertain the two-year-old's brain, because I just kept doing it. And then I remember hearing like the screeching, like, yell of somebody saying, "The baby," you know? And then, but I was in this like capsule, right? Where I was in the zone and I was clearly just enjoying this sort of experiment of fire and skin, you know? And then the long and short of it is that like I get swooped up you know, the men get relegated to outside and the women, you know, are all screaming about my goodness. And then I get grabbed by all these women and then I get taken to the kitchen and my hand gets, you know, stuck under the faucet, cold water on it. And like, but I remember being held right like this and looking back and really being confused about like, why is everyone yelling and why are people mad suddenly? I was, you know, and my memory of it though, is that I remember a kitchen full of multiple generations of young women, like my mother, who would have been 22 at the time, aunts, grandmas, and more. Like if you were to ask me how many people were in that room, it was probably, you know, 40. And my mom, of course, now, you know, says, no, it was like four of us. You know, it was your grandma, it was me, it was your auntie, whatever. But it's funny that you say that you picture me with a group of, because that's how I picture myself. I think that even in my most early memories, I feel myself with both the mommies and the aunties mm-hmm. and the cousins. But if I'm honest, all of the ones who also came before me who maybe weren't in that room physically, but were in my room, in that room in some other way. And so I do, I think that I replicate that a lot in my life. I still have my amazing, beautiful South American family, but they're far away. And I feel like maybe what I've done almost unwittingly is I've created that around myself wherever I go, right? And New York has been very good to me. My sabbatical after leaving tech was very good to me and good for me. But yeah, I'm so lucky. I'm lucky to have people like Catherine Colbert, Marie Wilson, Gloria Felt. I mean, these are women that in some cases I studied in school. And now they're in my company and they're supporting my crazy adventures and making sure that when I walk into a room, they're almost my advance team. Yeah. They've talked to someone, you know. Peter Knight has become a mentor. He co-founded Generation with Al Gore. And I did a speech earlier this year immediately following Al Gore. I was a little nervous because he's a pretty good speaker. But Peter made sure that Al knew that I was coming, you know, and so I've been really fortunate to have a lot of elder women and some, you know, elder men sort of who have my back. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Brava. Yes. Let's talk about Brava. Yeah. Your definition is that you fund companies as an investment firm that have a measurable impact on women's lives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just want to talk about why. Why is that so critical to the health of our societies?
Well, interesting, because usually people ask me, why not women founders, right? But you're saying, why does a measurable impact on women matter to society? You know, I've learned, I don't come from the nonprofit space. But I was in it briefly at Barnard, and I was able to be exposed to so much research. And what I sort of intuitively knew to be true, and I think that what we in our families maybe intuitively know to be true, that the women in the family tend to be the nucleus of the family. It turns out when you measure it, it turns out at scale, when you look at the work of global NGOs, it turns out that the data actually supports that. The data supports that the best use of, for example, you know, global development dollars is to inject them into the women in a society, because then, you know, upwards of 70-80%, depending on what study you're looking at, is reinjected into the economy, right? Whereas if you put it with the men in the society, it goes to many other things and not always anywhere near their own communities, or it's not reinvested at all. And so I take some of that learning and I bring it into the for-profit world, and I look at where do we have undervalued assets, right? I tried to see if there was an overlap between the thesis that I know moves society forward and the thesis that makes us money as investors. And I wasn't banking on that being the case, but it turns out it is. It turns out when you look at the most successful investors, people like Warren Buffett, they are all about taking undervalued assets and investing in them. They're all about when everybody's pulling out of things during a recession, for example, he's putting money in, right? And if you look at the trajectory of his investments, that thesis has panned out pretty well for him. So I found, you know, an overlap between these two things. The things the strategies that are most impactful for the world happen to be the strategies that also translate into really great long-term viable investment strategies.
Absolutely. And you're right now, you know, when you write in your new book, congratulations
Thank
on
you.
Your new book, in Leapfrog, that you're advising, you know, kind of a big through line is play big. We don't have time to play small. The stakes are too high. Things are just so critical. Mm. Women and people of color to uplift and start this revolution of yeah. women power. And it's just, it's an urgency that I feel is perfect for this moment that we inhabit. And you're very brazen in saying we need to level the playing field.
Yeah.
Can you talk about Leapfrog? What that means? Why is it? What's the urgency?
Yeah.
As you see it.
What's helpful, I think, when I tell people about that is to explain maybe sort of the roots. And I had really hoped, for example, that the word shortcut would be in the cover of the book. If it were up to me, I think I might have even called it Shortcuts. Because even though that word and that concept isn't on the cover of the book, let me be really clear that the book is 50 shortcuts. 50 shortcuts for taking down the patriarchy, for circumventing the status quo, for whatever you want to call it, but like 50 shortcuts for women to win in a system that largely locks them out, right? But we weren't able to do that because we tested the word shortcuts and we found that women, especially women of color, felt that the moment they saw the word shortcut, they equated it with the word cheating. And that was tough for me because I was really committed to this idea that like there's this urgency and we must take shortcuts. But you know, we agreed that I wasn't gonna win that battle on the cover of a book, and instead I sort of put it on the inside of the book. But the reason for my sort of passion around the idea of shortcuts is because around the time that I started writing the book, the World Economic Forum released a study that said that we're going to get to gender parity if we continue at the rate that we're on in 170 years, which felt devastating, right? And it if you compare that, if you compare the 170 years with the fear that we have of taking shortcuts, with the sense, and I would argue almost the collective trauma that we have about being accused of being the affirmative action candidate, the token woman, that you only got your job because of that some quota or something, that sort of collective concern that we have for not being treated as though we were given a favor and feeling the necessity to earn it, to get 3 masters, to follow the rules, to get perfect scores, to do everything exactly impeccably the way that the rules outline them for us, I think that it's holding us back. And I think that when we look at anybody who was successful, male or female, but especially male, they took shortcuts. And they call them hacks, they call them efficiencies, they call them, you know, the old boys network, whatever. But it's a leg up.
Trust funds, legacy,
you know. Some of those things are the sort of things that you can actively pursue, and some of them are things that you are maybe just unconscious of. You know, I mean, the person who was born in Beverly Hills versus the person that was born in the south side of Chicago, guess what? Beverly Hills person took a shortcut, you know? Whether they were conscious of it or aware of it or whether they did it willingly, those are shortcuts. And so I think that instead of saying, and I don't think that it's a bad thing to point some of these out when they're not fair, when they're not ethical, but I live in the here and the now. You know, and I would rather expend my energy rather than pointing out all of the things that are sort of unfair. I know that especially like women entrepreneurs, they're living in the here and the now. Whether it's fair, whether it's just is irrelevant. The fact is they have a business to run, and most women own businesses. In fact, 98% of them haven't crossed the $1 million a year in revenue threshold. Those women are not worried about what's just and what's not just. They're just worried about surviving. And for them, I wanted to equip them with a set of shortcuts that will arm them with tools that are comparable to the ones that the men who have been successful have been using since, you know, the dawn of time, right? And so I just kind of figure, you know, fight fire with fire. Like, those shortcuts aren't going anywhere, so let's equip women with our own, right? Mm-hmm. And let's also give them an example of one or two amazing entrepreneurs that have actually executed on that shortcut, so that it's not just me parroting out some advice, but it's actually here's a formula and here's somebody's, you know, footsteps that you can follow. And they're men and they're women, mm-hmm. which is also really important to me, because we need all hands on deck. We can't just limit ourselves to the examples that women set.
Right. Right. Yeah. And the collective trauma, it really speaks to me because it's, you know, you look at a job description and women are going to say, oh, I need to fulfill
every
single
thing.
One before mm-hmm. the research shows, you know, before I will apply, whereas the man feels like he has to, you know, fulfill maybe, what, 50, 60%.
Yep. Or none and pick up the phone and call a buddy, right?
And or that.
And doesn't lose sleep over it.
Right.
So that's fine.
That's the way it's done. We just circumvent and it's who we know. It's mm-hmm. our network and they're right. It works. So it's to get at the root of that, and you know, maybe that's a different conversation, but at your level, you're just saying,
I'm just saying we don't have time to sort of lament. There are social justice warriors that are out there saying, this is not fair, this should be illegal, this we should, you know, call out and protest on the streets about. And I agree with all of that. I just think that while we fix those systems, we have babies to feed, families to educate, you know, economies to take over. I mean, we have things to do.
Things to burn down.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And that's funny because your work today really does focus on both fronts, though, because at Brava, you are working at the systemic level.
I am.
And then through the book, you're really working on those individual empowerment. And,
yeah.
And it's both. It's not either or.
No, it's absolutely both. And part of Leapfrog for me was, as an investor, I have to say no a lot. In fact, I have to say no probably 99.9% of the time. And so I say no sometimes to women-owned businesses, for example, that are viable, that are good, solid businesses that deserve to be invested in and also that deserve to be armed with tools to succeed. They just don't happen to meet my very specific thesis, right? But it doesn't mean that they're not good, solid businesses. And so I wrote it in a way to be able to give those great businesses a set of tools that they deserve to have, even if I personally don't invest in them.
Yeah, yeah. How does that work inside of you? I feel like for those right now who feel a sense of overwhelm with the state of our world, the state of mm-hmm. our nation, maybe a sense of powerlessness mm-hmm. With the individual, on the individual level, and who maybe don't have a platform at the systemic level, like, and you do, and you've created that, you've, you know, worked your ass off. It's kind of an odd question, but how do you hold both the individual and the systemic inside of you? And where do you, like, prioritize, or how do you, how does that work inside of you? Does that make
any
sense? Yeah,
no, I hear you, because it's really easy to wake up every morning and want to boil the ocean, right? I mean, I think that we're compelled to do that, and in the absence of any real easy formula to do that, it can be really overwhelming, right? You know, I try, to sort of, what is that horrible expression, how do you eat an elephant, you know, one little chunk at a time, right? And so I try to make sure that my days are made up of sort of three categories of things, right? One category being just the part where I stay sane, because I'm not good to anybody unwell, right? And I've been down that path.
Yeah.
And I worked myself to the point of making myself sick. And so I know what that's like, and I know that that's not good for anyone. And so, for example, every morning before 10 a.m. is my time. Mm-hmm. I do not take meetings. My team knows not to book me anything before 10 a.m. First of all, I'm not a morning person. Second of all, I'm definitely a night owl. So the morning is my time to meditate, to walk my dog religiously. You know, that's not something that I outsource to anybody else. In the morning is me and my dog time. Or because I'm a night owl, maybe it's sleep-in time, you know, but it's me time. That's sort of one category of things. The second category of things is making sure that at some point during the day, I am making one step forward in something big, right? Whether it's writing the scaffolding of an op-ed that at some point I will publish, whether it is, you know, sitting with my co-writer when I was writing the book and spending some time on that. It's those little steps towards the big picture that just make me feel like, okay, that's an important project and I haven't abandoned it. I did a little something towards it every day. And then I'll be honest, the rest of my day is spent, you know, putting out fires and thinking about the tactical sort of day-to-day individual things, right? Talking to a founder, for example, that I'm enamored with right now, two founders, who are selling human mother's milk into NICUs all over the country, right? And they have just scaled where they went from a capacity of being able to process about 1,000 gallons a month and selling to various different NICUs around the country to now moving to Nevada, where they got a government subsidy, to be able to build a much bigger plant where they'll have a capacity to process about 1,000 gallons a day.
Wow.
Once we get into that scale, now the next question is, well, why only sell to NICUs? why not, given that their technology allows them to store human mother's milk for 30 days at room temperature, why not put it in every store in America and beyond, right? So for me, it may seem tactical, right? And they need an equipment loan, or they need this, or they need that, and it's a phone call, and it's a brainstorming, and it's really deep into the weeds of how do we get them from point A to point B and beyond. But it's rooted in that bigger picture strategy of having them hopefully take over the world, right? But it is very tactical. And I think that, you know, I would say for women who maybe feel like those three buckets are two buckets too many, some people just have a strength. And the strength is, you know, I'm an executor, you know, or the strength is I'm really bad at the details. I'm a big picture thinker. Pick your buckets, right? And then I think make a little tiny dent in them every day and know that I couldn't, for example, put my body on the line and be arrested at the Supreme Court the way that Bob Bland and so many of my other friends who were physically there a few weeks ago or 2 weeks ago did for a number of different reasons. But there's a really great quote from Alice Walker. It's a long, beautiful quote, but the end of the book has this piece of it where she says, you know, revolution or not, they must eat, right? And so some of us are on the front lines putting our bodies on the line and getting arrested, and some of us are funding, bailing them out of jail, feeding. You know, we're all sort of in it, but we're in it in the way that makes most sense to each of us.
In our lane and having presence of mind of the larger knitted fabric that we're part of.
Right.
But that we don't always know that we're part of.
Yeah. In our thread, like in the I think about like braided conversations and really, you know, cross-discipline efforts that require a lot of collaboration. It's funny, I used to say in our lane or in my lane a lot, and I've been saying it less because I had another book-related conversation that came up recently where I was told to stay in my lane, because a percentage of the proceeds of Leapfrog are going to Vote Run Lead, right?
Yes.
Which is the organization that has managed to get more women into office than any other for the last over a decade, and specifically more women of color into office. Mm-hmm. And I had a number of people tell me that I should stay in my lane, that this is a book about entrepreneurship, and if I was going to give proceeds to anything, I should give them to one of the many worthy organizations that help, you know, entrepreneurs in some capacity. And I don't think that that's a bad idea, but I really worry when people are telling me, stay in your lane. First of all, I think that's just code for stay small. Mm-hmm. So you know, no thank you. But I also think that there was this sense of like, we've forgotten, especially some of these people who are in my community, who care about the same issues that I care about, we've forgotten that the entire purpose of empowering women economically, of putting more money into the wallets of as many women as possible, is so that we can shift the power structure. And, you know, another way that we can very effectively shift the power structure is to put women into elected office. And so, to me, this is a natural marriage. And to think that I had, you know, a good dozen people telling me that they didn't see the connection made me realize that we need to be making that connection more explicit. We need to be explaining to people that we're all in the same fight, and some of us are doing it with startups, and some of us are doing it, you know, getting arrested at the Supreme Court, and some of us are on the inside of big corporations moving the dial for women to be able to thrive in those environments, but we're all connected, right? And this idea of trying to separate us, you're either a nonprofit or a for-profit, or you're an activist, or you're an entrepreneur, like staying in our swim lane in those cases, I think is just a way to divide and conquer, and I'm not having it.
Such a good point, and the braid analogy is such a helpful metaphor. Mm-hmm. Like that's so, and I think that's the same way, because it's so funny because I pulled out a quote from you, but you summarized it beautifully regarding Vote Run Lead. We talked to Erin in the winter.
Oh, really?
Right, when she announced her pregnancy, she's amazing. Mm-hmm. It was incredible. But
by the way, she also came out of the Athena Center.
Did she? Mm-hmm.
So Brava and Vote Run Lead both came out of the Athena Center. It's not called Feminist Mecca for nothing. These women's colleges do. And I didn't even go to Barnard. I went to Columbia, but I sometimes disappoint people at Columbia by telling them that the best thing about my time at Columbia was having discovered Barnard. I mean, there's something to be said for an environment that, you know, replicates what we want society to look like, right? Where women are holding positions of power, and they're running things, and you know, allowed to really thrive. You know, there isn't anything that unique about Barnard in that, you know, the classes are the same classes. You've got Columbia students who can take classes at Barnard. The Barnard students can all take Columbia classes. But there's something about creating an environment where you clear the path and you remove obstacles and you just let women do what they're going to do, right? And what happens is amazing things.
Well, and what's so powerful about that is it's a lived example that, that grounds us, our vision in reality now. Mm-hmm. That's incredibly transformative because we can see it and touch it.
Well, if you think about what we're talking about now with women surviving harassment and just like the daily microaggressions of an environment, most work environments that are not really designed for us to thrive, an environment like that, an environment like a Barnard or like the, you know, Catholic girls' school that I went to that was a tremendous experience, it might not be reality. It might not be real to live in an environment where every president of every club, every captain of every team, every position of leadership is held by a woman. That might not be real life, but it is to your experience, to your point, it's a lived experience. And the same way that we embody the trauma and the things that happen to us in a negative way, there is something that I cannot articulate about living in an environment where in your bones, in your skin, in your psyche, at all times, leaders are women. And even if it's just a temporary space that you held, you know, or that you hold for your daughters, if it's a year, if it's 2 years, if it's high school, if it's college, it's still something that becomes almost muscle memory, and you don't forget it. And I think that that's a reason that Margaret Mead happened. That's the reason that all of these amazing women, Gloria Steinem, I mean, all of these people are products of single-sex environments for women, right?
I want to transition to role models because your time, so talk about this however you want to talk about it. There's a couple of questions here. Your sabbatical from tech, you're leaving tech. Pivoting to playwriting, right?
Yeah.
I mean, who does that?
Yeah.
It's amazing. So that's its own story.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to. But when you were there, when you were at Columbia, you write and you talk about how haunted you were that you left tech, maybe not as evolved and as equal as you. You didn't make it better when you were there, you felt like, and that really, that haunted you.
Yeah.
And you write that about, like, very vulnerably and really compassionately for that time in your life. Mm-hmm. But you changed it. You acted on it. You didn't leave it there. That wasn't the end of the story. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that realization, because you felt that, you took that into your body. So I want to know that process. Mm-hmm. And it really created a real second act, like an encore at however old you were, very young still, but you created a second act where activism and advocacy were absolutely embedded, absolutely woven and braided into everything you would do after. Can you talk about that reckoning?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So even though it makes absolutely no sense to people at first glance, throughout my entire career in tech, I was that engineer who could articulate really complex concepts, computational linguistics, machine learning, natural language processing. That was my field, right? And it was definitely my talent to articulate that to the layman and to help people understand not just what these things were, but why they mattered, right? And so I had already sort of embodied this idea that one of my, you know, talents, and maybe even the thing that helped me get ahead in my career was my ability as a storyteller. But I'm also humble enough to know that when you're surrounded by engineers and you're a good storyteller, let's be honest, you're a big fish, little pond, right? And so when I decided to take my sabbatical, I was like, what does a mediocre storyteller do once she's out of that little tiny pond to really improve on that skill? And I thought, well, I cannot think of anyone better than the New York theater community, right? To really focus on this skill and to polish it. And so, The only reason that I landed at Columbia to study playwriting is because Columbia have a sense of humor. I mean, the application was ridiculous. You know, they asked for an artist portfolio, and the answer was not applicable. Like, I don't have an artist portfolio. I'm sorry, but I still would love to hang out with you guys for a couple years. So I think they probably did it in part because they thought I would be a good donor post-graduation or something. I have no idea, but to this day. But it was a great decision because I think that it took a skill that was a strong business skill that I already maybe had and that I was passionate about, and it strengthened it. And so while I was there, there was a gentleman who was head of the PhD department, Bill Worthen, who made a point to say, everything that you write about, no matter what it's about, plot lines vary, your circumstances vary, but the underlying thread behind everything that you write is fundamentally some sort of a reckoning between women and power. Like, that seems to be the through line. No matter what you write, it makes me wonder what your career was like and what it is you're trying to work out right now. And I was like, what are you talking about? I was tired. Like, the last 15 years in tech were just really hard, and I worked a lot, and I made myself, you know, exhausted and burnt out, and now I'm taking a few years off. Like, I was so deep in the weeds that I didn't see it, but it was coming out of my writing. And so he says to me, yeah, okay. There's a woman across the street who argued the landmark Supreme Court case that saved Roe v. Wade in 1992. She started the Center for Women's Leadership across the street at Barnard. You should go meet her, if nothing else, because she would make for a really great character study. And of course, you don't have to tell me twice. I'm like, yeah, set it up. And so I go, I meet with Catherine Colbert, who argued Planned Parenthood versus Casey, who at that point was the executive director of the Athena Center. And within 5 minutes, she's like, okay, you're not a playwriting student. What's your story? And she immediately sniffs me out, and she wants to hear what my story is and who I am and what I'm doing here. And she hears who I am, and she says, you've got to come back here, and you've got to help us figure out the Center for Women's Leadership, because they were going through the thing that I think every startup goes through at year three, roughly, which I call the existential crisis, right? At 3 years old, most companies, big or small, are going through that time where they're trying to figure out why they're here, what they're about, you know, what's our purpose. She was going through that. And so I stepped in at that point and started advising her. And what was made very clear to me is that despite her being somebody who, again, I read about in the textbooks in school, there was something that I had to offer her, right? There was some perspective that I had that could add value, and as intimidating as it was to work with her, it was amazing to think that, you know, I could contribute. And so over the course of the next many months, we ended up cooking up this idea of starting the Center for Women Entrepreneurs inside of the Athena Center. And in that time, what happened was that the students got to know me, we built programs, we built program for adults as well, but what I found is that the very bright students at Barnard and at Columbia looked at my bio and realized, oh, she's a techie. Even though I was sort of not trying to be that, and I was sort of on break and on sabbatical from that, they're smart, they looked at my background, and so there were a whole crop of women who wanted to get into tech and would come to me and say, can you help me get a job at Microsoft? Can you help me get a job at Google? Can you help me build my resume? Can you help me because the coding classes are really unwelcoming to me? And so I would get all of these questions because I was the sort of techie in residence in hiding, but they figured it out. And I realized in my heart of hearts that as much as I wanted to help them, I knew that I had left the industry worse than I found it. I knew that there are today half as many women graduating in engineering as there were when I started. I knew that the environments that were toxic then were infinitely more toxic now, because like any weed that's allowed to grow without any sort of, you know, recrimination, it just continues and it spreads and it becomes stronger. And I thought, you know, as I'm figuring out why I left, I'm realizing the last thing I want to do is to send this new generation of brilliant women back into there, right? It felt like throwing them into the lion's den. Mm-hmm. And I was overwhelmed with guilt. And I realized I can either make it a campaign to go out and tell all of them what I experienced and that they should steer clear of it, which is ridiculous. We need more women in STEM. We don't need Natalie going off on a campaign telling them to avoid it at all costs. And I thought, well, okay, so
that's one idea.
I know, like option A,
billboard.
He's like, no. And then I realized option B was the only real option, which is that I needed to put my big girl panties on and get back into the game. And so as much as it was beautiful to be in the ivory tower of an Ivy League college, I realized that I needed to get back in. And I thought, well, how? How do I do that? And what is the biggest dilemma facing women in tech, but also more broadly women in entrepreneurship? And if it is the biggest nut that needs to be cracked, I know that I'll be able to get excited about it. And it became very clear after years of working with women entrepreneurs that the biggest nut to crack here is capital. Mm-hmm. Women don't need more education. They don't need, you know, it's not to say that these things aren't important, but we're doing fine. We're getting more degrees than men, right? And right around the time that we start getting more degrees than men, someone like Peter Thiel comes out and says, you don't need college, and starts paying people $200,000 to skip college, right? Mm-hmm. Thanks, Peter. But I think that what I wanted to do is just go back in, fix the thing that was the most acute problem, the thing that'll move the dial the most, and that was finance. And so I definitely took one for the team, leaving tech and going into finance. It kind of feels sometimes like I went from bad to worse, but it's where we're most needed.
Yeah. So another through line that I didn't catch earlier, but is coming through loud and clear, is that you find, and it brings us back to the
But I'm motivated by guilt.
That's your Catholic roots. I know exactly where that's from, because I got it too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, guilty. it's that you find, I actually did have a question. I did write a question about this. It's interwoven in your story. And I didn't even realize how full this was until talking to you. That's why I'm kind of having trouble processing it. Because when I think about my heroes, like my true leadership, there's always kind of the outward success and what they do. Mm. But what really moves me and inspires me, and where I hunger and long for stories, is the inner change, the transformation. And you're really vulnerable and honest around that. And I just really appreciate that. So you take us, you've taken me through in your writing, and I'm sure I'm not alone in thinking this, that inner transformation and going. Mm-hmm. But what I'm realizing is that, and part of that was your identity. Like you began to own who you were as a Latina, as a woman, your heritage. You took it from something maybe you tried to blend in to own. So I want to talk about that in your own language, please. Mm-hmm. But also, you take what's there and you change yourself, like you're that finding therapy wherever you go. Like that story again. It's like, but there's something to that I don't quite have the language for yet, but it's really powerful. Like it's the aunties in the room. It's figuring out who can help you, and it's like this guidance, this intuition that you are able to navigate to change yourself in that moment. Does that resonate?
It's funny because I have called it cultural agility before, mm-hmm. but culture defined broadly, right? And culture as in the culture of tech, the culture of academia. I think that what happens is, and I mentioned this in the book, right, where people talk about, what is it, the vocal fry or women apologizing or all the different ways that women communicate that are bad. And how we need to do the better way and be more assertive and do all these things. I worry about that sort of language because what I have found, and I think maybe this is what you're talking about, is that it isn't about one way or another way. It's about the fact that we are agile and you have to retain the core, of course, of who you are, but life puts you under different constraints. Life colors you in different shades depending on where you are, and you can retain the core of who you are and still be adaptable and agile and be able to sort of roll with the punches of where you happen to be, or not always punches because it's not always negative. Sometimes it's about an environment that brings out something beautiful in you, right? And I think that for me, having grown up multicultural, I think almost predisposed me to be really good at that. And so in the book, I advocate for that. Even if you are somebody who grew up in the suburbs speaking one language, exposed to one culture, it doesn't matter. You can still learn and be inspired by people who grow up multicultural, who do that code switch, right? Mm-hmm. Who are speaking sort of proper white American English in one context, and then with their Jamaican family are speaking their patois. And, you know, there's something about that, that instead of maligning people for not picking a lane, right, let's look at the beauty that comes with that agility and know that when a woman is apologizing too much, or when a woman is using these sort of strategies that we've used to play small, one of the things that we're also using is an increased level of sensitivity. So yeah, are some of those tactics not, you know, counterproductive? Fine. But if we look at the nucleus of why a woman is doing that, it's because she's reading the room. It's because she's not feeling empowered. It's because she's trying to make everyone happy and listen and watch for all the different signs in the room and figuring out how to adjust accordingly. Those same skills can be used productively. And I would hate to shut that down, right? I would hate to say, stop using those skills. Stop using those amazing listening, watching, perceptive skills. I would rather redirect them towards behavior that's, you know, that's more productive. And then over here, yes, by all means, learn how to wear that hat. Learn how to be in that negotiating table with a bunch of people that look like they're comparing penis sizes. And learn how to speak the way that they speak. It doesn't make you not be you. It gives you another tool in the toolbox. It gives you another language to speak. It makes you multilingual, right? And I think maybe that's what I have unwittingly been doing all this time, right? I felt like a fish out of water going to theater school. I remember my very first class, they were telling Shakespeare jokes and Brecht jokes. I did not know who Brecht was. And for anybody listening, Brecht is a playwright who was born prior to World War II in Germany, who, you know, is in the theater world sort of second to Shakespeare. But here I am, a business person, parachuted into theater class, and I've got my phone underneath the table and I'm Googling Brecht. Not only did I not get the joke, I didn't even know who the dude was, you know. I think that that level of agility, no matter where you are, mm-hmm. serves you, right? Yeah.
And not being afraid of it. Not being afraid to put yourself in situations that...
Right. And I would argue that because women work, live, function in a world that is really not designed for us to thrive, even if you look at the corner office of most corporations, right? I think that we could take it from the negative, right? The same way that growing up multicultural, I could have taken that as, damn, I don't belong anywhere. Mm-hmm. I go to Ecuador, my family say I'm Americanized. I'm in the US and I'm everybody's, you know, token Latina friend, right? I could have taken that and said, I don't belong anywhere. I live in this liminal place. But instead, I took it as, I belong in all these places. I'm a little bit Ecuadorian, I'm a little bit Colombian, I'm a little bit, you know, from the US, but I kind of blend when I'm in India, and I love Japan, and I love living in Dublin, and Madrid was super fun. Like, I took that same set of sort of building blocks, and I took it to mean that I could belong anywhere, and I think that women have that ability to do the same thing. We live in a culture that's not designed for us to thrive, which makes us, by design, multicultural, right? We know how to function and survive in a world where you have to worry about whether your key is held to protect your safety when you're going through a parking lot. Like, all of these things could be part of the collective trauma, but they could also be part of the collective superpower.
Oh my God.
I think.
Yes. Done. There's nothing left to say.
If you'd like to hear more from Natalie Molina Nino, follow her at Natalie Molina on Twitter and Instagram. And if you're one of the millions of women who are starting her own business, or if you have a side gig that you'd like to scale, run, don't walk, to your local library and get her new book, Leapfrog, The New Revolution for Women Entrepreneurs. Links to everything and every way to find Natalie can be found on our website, 3ms.co. That's the number 3 and the letters ms.co. And while you're there, subscribe to our mailing list so you never miss a story from us.